You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Derek and Oliver, who are two esteemed Berkman alumni. Derek is a professor at the Berkman Law School, and Oliver is a security researcher at Akamai, and we'll give them a brief introduction and leave it to them. Thanks for joining us, guys.
So, thanks very much for having us. It's exciting. We're really glad to be here. It's nice to be on proverbially this side of the table, since we are both former Berkman interns. So you can be paid very slightly more, but not much more. So we wanted to do two things. One is just to sort of frame up what we're going to talk about. And the second, and probably more important of the two, is actually just to acknowledge Phil Malone, who is on vacation somewhere much more exciting even than Cambridge. But Phil, this paper really emerged out of a set of talks that Oliver and I had with Phil. And so it is as much, in some ways, his work as ours. And so we wish he could be here, but we just want to sort of acknowledge our intellectual debt to his sort of insight and hard work. And so what we really want to do is Oliver is going to set the stage. In other words, what is the problem? Why do we write this paper? What is the sort of social difficulty that we see? We'll both talk a little bit about our theory that security research actually represents an underrecognized form of peer production, the sort of thing that's studied by Yochai Benkler and Eric von Hippel and Jonathan Zittrain and others. And then we'll talk about the title, which is, how do we protect hackers from lawyers? Everybody wonders about this, but hackers are sort of specially in need of it. And then we want to ask you some questions, right? We want to sort of get the discussion going, figure out whether what we're saying makes sense, and so forth. And so with that, I'm going to let Oliver.
Thank you. All right, so like you said, this paper has been a long time coming. I've been, I guess, part of the hacker scene for over a decade now. And the way I ordered this is semi-historical. So the very first entry, Snowsoft, this was a group of guys. There were researchers in the truest sense of the word, and they found a bunch of vulnerabilities in a product that was produced by Hewlett-Packard. And they told Hewlett-Packard about it. And in the same email, they were like, you guys should consider hiring us to audit your products. We're very good at finding flaws. Look, here are 20 or so of the flaws we just found. To which Hewlett-Packard responded, wow, that's extortion. We're sending our lawyers. And so the story goes kind of back and forth like this, right? Billy Hoffman, Virgil Griffith, who was actually an intern here 2 years ago, I think, they found some problems with a piece of academic software, something used by universities to like manage the washing machines and the vending machines and such. And when he went forward with the flaws that he found, he was visited with, was it the Lanham Act? This is the trademark,
everything.
Right?
They threw everything, including the kitchen sink. They said Lanham Act, trade secret theft, computer fraud and abuse, which in this title, they sort of everything that you could think of from an internet law class, they got in the complaint.
The lawyers came back and said, you broke every law you possibly could have. The next one, which was actually kind of recent, was the MBTA Charlie Card hackers, right? These are three students at MIT under Ron Rives. So has anyone heard of RSA? I'm hoping many people here have heard. He's the R in RSA. His students had a project where they figured out that the cards that you use to swipe on the T were vulnerable to certain types of attacks. The MBTA responded very poorly. And if you read our paper, you can find out all the dirty details about this. Similarly, Chris Padgett, he found problems with HID, which are the little corporate cards that you see, the white ones that people swipe into buildings with. This also had a problem. It was called a replay attack, which is if I see you swiping in, I can just clone it, and now I can swipe in as you. That's a pretty major security flaw for something that's protecting buildings from intruders. And so they came after him with a patent attack. They said, you made a cloner, which is infringing on our patent to make these things, and that's bad. Mike Lynn is probably the most recent, I think. Are you the most recent?
I think Chris is slightly more recent.
Actually, Chris might be a little bit more recent. I might have these in semi-historical order. He found a problem in Cisco, which is what pretty much powers most of the internet. And Cisco responded by having the people that were putting on the conference that he was speaking at rip out all the pages that even mentioned his talk. This is a quick history, right? Our paper details a little bit more. I just thought these were some of the cool highlights. But the pattern is the same, right? Researchers go through different products and they figure out flaws. So essentially they're providing this free work to corporations. And the corporations have many times responded by saying, "That's very nice. Please talk to our attorneys now." So these are the different threats, right? The cost alone of defending yourself against lawyers makes most researchers want to stop playing the game. Some of these other ones, financial liabilities, criminal liabilities are pretty bad. I think it's really mostly the financial side, right? You're doing free work on the hopes of getting some type of recognition for how smart you are so that you can get a real job. Defending yourself with an attorney is out of the question. So really the proposition that we're putting forward is, are we losing out as a society by squelching these people who are producing things that we feel are beneficial, right? These people are, in fact, making things safer. This is what I am saying, right? That the research these guys are doing are eventually getting folded back into the products, and these problems are getting solved. But the problem that we're starting to see, and the ones that we outlined in the paper, were that they might get sold to the Russian mafia, things of that nature. What I'm actually starting to see in the last 18 months is that people are just now starting to hoard their exploits, which is, I find a flaw, instead of telling anyone, I'm going to keep it to myself. And then I'm going to use it if and when I feel like it's the time to use it. And I think this is probably going to be a really fun question to ask you guys, if you feel that's more threatening than selling it to a Russian mob.
So one of the things Oliver has sort of started this theme is that we think that security research is another example of peer production. And this is in two ways. One is the sort of classic von Hippel-driven model of users tinkering, right? They are tweaking the software so that it functions in a way that is better suited to their needs and their environment, regardless of the sort of background set of intellectual property rules that govern that activity. And the second is what we might think of as bugs or bug fixes. So people are actually coming forward both with information about how to break something and potentially code that exploits it, and also potentially patches, right? This is how the open source software movement functions. And people are fall into roughly, we think, three camps. So why is it essentially that you might do this work? One is that you're being paid directly. So I did this for a summer as a QE or a quality engineering or quality assurance researcher. Your job directly is to do this sort of stuff. The other thing is that you can outsource this work. You can actually be a consultant who does this, or you can be somebody who's sort of a hired gun. The third version, the one that we're most interested in, is somebody who has no formal relationship with the producer of the software or the product. They are just outsiders. They are tinkerers. They are hackers. They are people who work independently. And so why is it, if you're this third party, right, this sort of third category of our ecosystem, why might you do this? And Oliver's talked about various reasons, right? So some of them are directly linked to compensation. I might do this as a proof of concept, show you, HP, how smart I am, so that I can lobby for a job, or I can lobby for you to contract with my company. The more interesting ones are the socially based ones. What you want to do is you just want to show you're smart, you're sort of elite overall. You do it because you have a particular ideological axe to grind. So you dislike Apple, or you love Linux, or you dislike Microsoft. You want to show that one product is better than another. And then also just sort of internal social signals within the community. Your reputation is important among other hackers. You want to prove that you're skillful. And so in some ways, what we think of is our argument is that, A, this is an interesting social phenomenon in and of itself, is that the production of this is not something that's directly compensated, but is quite powerful and quite spread nonetheless. And the second is, we argue that there are significant positive externalities from this. In other words, hackers create a social good without being paid for it. And yet, weirdly, the law actively discourages them from doing so. And so that leads to the core of our proposal. What we want to do is we want to realign these forces. We want the law to support productive activity rather than inhibiting it. So we'll talk briefly about our proposed remedies, and then we want to open it up for questions. We want to talk as little as possible. And so what we want to do is we want to essentially do three things. The first is to tweak the law. One thing Oliver mentions is that clever IP lawyers have hacked the law in the same way that coders have hacked the software. They're using laws such as intellectual property law, sometimes even trademark law, for purposes for which it was not initially designed. They're doing it to suppress this type of research. We want to change that by creating a shield, an exemption from liability that hackers could operate under so as to remove that threat, the fears of financial or criminal penalties. The second, probably even less realistic, if you can believe that, is that we want to change terms. The word hacker has just gotten soaked up by the media and judges who don't really understand technology and gets applied in a way that hacker used to be somebody who was a tinkerer, and now it's somebody who breaks things maliciously. And we think it's helpful, in a sort of Lakoffian sense, to actually change the terms so that we can change how people think about this. And then lastly, we want to change markets, right? We want to have some coordination to solve informational problems in the market for software security vulnerabilities. So what we would suggest is that our legal shield, which would protect hackers, requires that they do five things. And this is essentially along the lines of the responsible disclosure model that is somewhere in the middle, right? It's sort of the moderate position in the security researcher community, and Oliver can talk more about that. But we would essentially ask of them five things. The first is that the first person they tell is not CNN and it is not Slashdot, but it's the vendor. Right? The vendor is in the best position to fix an important security vulnerability. So you have to tell the vendor first. And second, you only get this if you're not selling the book, right? I don't want people selling it to the Russian mafia. I don't want them selling it on the underground. I think it's great if they sell it to the vendor, but we want to keep them from putting this out for auction. And this is because we think that bugs typically are worth more on the black market than on the white market. So if you want to run the risk of selling it for more money in the black market, that's great, but that's not something we want to encourage. As a general rule, we think that hackers should be testing on their own systems. In other words, they should not be taking over Harvard systems or the Berkman Center systems in order to test for flaws and vulnerabilities. Download a copy of the software and run it locally. The difficulty here that we want to get your insight on is, how does this work with cloud computing? Really difficult if what you're looking at is Amazon's EC2 or something like that. You can't, by definition, replicate it locally.
And just as a small anecdote for where we think this is heading, a friend of mine that does security research a couple years ago came to me and he had found a flaw in his web banking system. It was hopefully not Citibank, but given the recent story, it could have been. What he found was that he could alter in the URL, he saw his account number. And when he changed it one digit, he was in his wife's account and he hadn't signed in as her. You know what he did? He didn't tell the bank. He closed his accounts and he left. Now, he did that because he was afraid that the bank would respond with lawyers. And this is a real problem. This isn't an easy one to solve, right? Because it's also tricky if you're a researcher to not take down the system that you're testing. And if you take down Bank of America or Citibank, you've now done something that I don't agree with either. So anyway, I wanted to frame that a little bit better for everyone.
And as we move towards cloud computing, right, this problem gets harder and harder. And so we actually think there's a genuine difficulty with the project. The last two are, one, don't weaponize it, right? Don't write code that anybody who can click a button can exploit the flaw. So this is sort of up there with not selling the bug. Also, don't create ways so that people who are less sophisticated can break things. And lastly, we want them to create a trail. We want them to take advantage of this software clearinghouse, sort of along the lines of CertCC or the equivalent, as a way of intermediating communication between vendors and hackers. And we want them to essentially create an audit trail to show what they found, when they found it, and to provide a means of communication, even if that communication is anonymous, between the hacker and the software vendor, so that it can hopefully sort of speed patching. There's a couple of sort of fun issues in here. One is sort of more for the lawyers, which is this something that's better built as a specialized statute, sort of the anti-DMCA, if you will, something that specifically is a law that Congress passes that protects software security researchers. If that looks impossible for sort of public choice reasons, is this something that would better be handled by tweaking each of the doctrines that are sort of employed as a threat, right? So can we change fair use and copyright? Could we expand the extremely cramped experimental use exception in patent law, for example? Requires sort of doctrine by doctrine tweaking, but it might be more realistic. And the last thing that we're worried about a little bit is strategic behavior. In other words, if we create this shield, is it something that black hat actors are going to be able to avoid liability under? And if so, how bad a cost is that? So now, this is the point where we start asking you questions. This is really just to sort of kick off the discussion. Obviously, right, does this seem like a good idea? Was helpful, should we sort of carry on with this or go back to our day jobs? Equally important, right, we sort of teed up cloud and mobile computing, but there are at least a couple of other things we want to talk about. One is whether we should be thinking about hackers as whistleblowers, right? Sort of the Daniel Ellsbergs. And if so, is this something where we ought to tune this more towards whistleblower type protections, also somewhat cramped, at least in federal law? And then we sort of notice Stuxnet, right? Stuxnet is one of these things that exploits the hidden zero days that Oliver's talking about. Wired's latest article on this is quite good. It's something that is probably the first and most brilliant cyber weapon yet. In a world where there are things like Stuxnet out there, at least available to nation states, if not to eventually sort of terrorist groups and also the annoying teenager down the block, does this change the way that we've set up this regime? So with that, we're going to stop and ask you for your thoughts and questions.
Two comments, questions. The first was, you mentioned that the hacker should tell the vendor first, and there's an implication of there's a period of time that elapses, and that period of time seems to be one of the big contentious issues. How long do you wait? If I tell them they release a new version and they haven't fixed the bug, can I now go public with it? So I'll just start with that.
It's been sort of a battle for years, right? And there's been people that have put time limits on it. The time limits never really work out. People have tried to define reasonable. Sometimes it's 45 days, sometimes it's 90. I don't think it's a good idea to try and put an actual number down. I think what I've generally gone with as a rule when I've advised people is as long as there's still communication, you should continue working with them. If they're saying, we're trying, we're really working on this, you should give them a little bit of slack. Sometimes it really is difficult to test a patch on hundreds of thousands of configurations. Sometimes, am I allowed to name names? Okay, so people like Oracle are notoriously bad, right? They put out 4 patches like every 2 years, maybe. And so if you report something to them, they might say, great, thank you, and not get back to you for like 18 months. That's kind of unacceptable, I think. So it's not something I think we can solve, but again, for guidelines, I think as long as there's reasonable communication back and forth, it's a good thing. When the communication stops, that's when you need to start finding ways to escalate.
My second thought was that the terms of service might be quite relevant in terms of contract law as another one of these legal domains, particularly with respect to online services. Like, I haven't looked at them because they're ridiculously boring and long, but I assume they say you're not allowed to mess with the security of our system or test the security of our system or something.
Sure.
I don't know if any judges ever said, well, that's an unconscionable contract. I don't imagine they would.
You know, I know Derek has talked to me about this before, but there's been in the past people that have tried to say, like, you can't, in their contracts, they'll say, you can't try and benchmark our product. And I believe a judge has come back on that one and said,
Network Associates tried this. They actually had it, but they had prior publication approval over any benchmarking. And it got challenged by Andrew Cuomo when he was New York's Attorney General. And they eventually just agreed that they would stop doing it. He challenged under consumer protection law, interestingly enough. You're right that almost anything that a researcher does is going to violate the terms of service, right? They'll probably all have some sort of broad clause that says you can only use it this way. And there's at least two things to think about here. One is, as you say, contract law. The good news about contract, right, is that contract doesn't have much of a hammer behind it because you got to show damages. So, okay, I breached it, but what are your damages if you're Amazon? 6 cents, right? So if it was tort, then I'm worried because there's sort of punitive damages flowing behind that, and that's nasty. The worry for a while, right, with the sort of Lori Drew case, was that prosecutors might be able to reify a violation of terms of service into a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim. In other words, you are no longer protected by the terms of service, hence you've exceeded authorization to use this system, hence it's a CFAA offense. It looks like, right, I mean, we only have the district court decision in California to go by, but it looks like that route hasn't been successful. So I'm with you, the contract is really, really important, but I worry about it more as a sort of criminal tool than a civil one. Let's see, okay, we're going to randomly call people. Go ahead.
Most of what you were talking about had to do with, you know, intellectual property law and its uses and abuses, but the first example you gave, you said that these people said, you know, here's a bug, hire us and we'll fix it. and HP said that's extortion. It does sound a little like extortion. How do you deal with that?
I don't think the phrasing of the email, and I don't think I've actually ever seen the email. I don't think the phrasing of the email was, here are 22 bugs. If you don't give us money, we go public. I think it was more along the lines of, we found these bugs. We're really smart. Have you thought about hiring us for security work? Well, maybe. I don't
That has something to do with intellectual property law, that particular issue.
Right. I don't know how extortion law works. I certainly don't feel like the people that I've talked to as researchers certainly aren't trying to extort people. And there are clear cases of extortion out there. They'll say, we downloaded all the credit cards out of your database. Give us $50,000 or they go public. That's extortion.
You're absolutely right that one of the things we're thinking about, right, is we deliberately, for this proposal, left criminal law untouched. Because we are worried that exempting from criminal liability just gives up too much in terms of the ability to deter bad actors. So the real difficulty with this, right, is that when we're dealing with hackers, very sorry, I used to be a systems engineer myself, but hackers, by and large, not great on communication skills, right? So they're going to say, I found a bunch of stuff and I'd like some money, right? But they're trying not to link the two. When you link the two, that's when you get close to extortion. But that's difficult, right? And that's the sort of thing where, you know, sort of, that's actually sometimes where it is helpful to find lawyers. But the classic extortion model is when we actually do want to deter. It's this gray area that is admittedly tricky.
What about the vendor who's actually the person you're trying to hide this stuff from? So take, for example, like the iPhone, right? There are a bunch of 0 days out there right now that are, or unpatched vulnerabilities, I should say, that are specifically being used so you can jailbreak the iPhone. Similar things have happened with Sony and that whole kerfuffle. So how would this deal with that? And the first requirement seems to go directly in, you know, opposition to this idea, right? That you have the ability to hack your own phone.
Yeah, I mean the first thing is that you should be talking to the vendor. I think if you're really trying, I mean, if you're just gonna hoard them and use them for their purposes, that's fine, but we have to draw a line for protection, right? This is going to be a negotiation, right? There has to be a treaty. Like, you give a little, we give a little. And so as the hacker side, it's like, look, you can't sue us for just ridiculous purposes anymore and abuse other parts of the law, and in return, we will give you the vulnerabilities that we find. I think that's a very fair treaty to put out there.
Able to program on our own devices, right? Because then we no longer have that ability.
Well, hoarding a vulnerability is not really a detectable thing.
Like, raise your hand and say, I'll be counted when you create this, because I, even though you're like, I don't want to not jailbreak my phone anymore, you can just recuse yourself from that. I mean, this is for people that are doing the research and falls under that.
Sort of opposed to each other. I find a vulnerability, I must, by this law or by this framework.
No, if you want protection.
Okay.
If you want protection from Apple, in this particular case, right,
from suing you using whatever their lawyers can come up with, you follow these guidelines. Right now, there's nothing. Like, literally, right now, you're just naked, and they can do whatever they want to you. Here, you have a shield.
This is an opt-in system, right? So you can completely ignore our set of rules, and then it's just the sort of standard vanilla law. The difficulty, right, is that something that lets you jailbreak an iPhone is a dual-use device. It's a gun. And so you're using the gun for laudable purposes, arguably, right, which is to actually sort of be able to interact with your device. That gun in the hands of a hacker also lets somebody else take over their iPhone, right? So we are not willing to actually, that's a bad trade from our perspective, right? And so the answer is, if you don't like the jailbroken iPhone, it's Verizon Droid, right? It's not as cool as the iPhone.
But those are the same thing. There are exploits for those that do the
absolutely
exact, legitimately the exact same thing. It's not a problem with the technology, it's a problem with the carriers and the people, you know, companies wanting to lock their devices down. It's a different tension.
Absolutely right. So we, you know, Apple is obnoxious about the iPhone, but I'm not worried about it right until Apple starts turning into Windows, right? At the point where everybody's got the iPhone, then maybe you have to tweak our system. But where there's sufficient sort of market exit strategies, we're sort of less worried about it at this point. Molly, go ahead.
So my question comes off of your weaponization or anti-weaponization criteria and is also slightly more complicated on top of that. So to bring up an example and to be a sort of, and to be a devil's advocate for a second, Fire Sheep has been explained to me by several people who know what they're talking about and who may or may not be sitting at this table as a way to bring to light in a violent and very attention-getting way a vulnerability that had been around for a very long time, that people had been ignoring. And so Fire Sheep was a method of saying, we need to do something about this right now. And this was actually the argument that was put forward by the gentleman who developed Fire Sheep. So in this case, weaponization was used perhaps messily for a potentially laudable purpose. Your system depends an awful lot on the good faith of developers. The point you just made is, as long as you're talking, you shouldn't expose it. However, for your system to function to not only protect hackers, but also improve security, not only does there have to be communication, but there has to be action. And there can be people who say, or companies who say, thanks for the tip, we're not going to sue you, we're also not going to do jack shit about it. So it does your system come with accompanying liability on the part of the company where you say, you were informed. If you do not take action within a certain amount of time, you inherit liability for anything that happens because of the exposure of this bug.
We haven't so far. And so we're thinking about this in two ways. One is that we think that reputation will do some work for us, right? So what we've built in, and this has to do with the sort of delay problem I think you brought up earlier, which is how long do you wait? And, you know, the sort of guidelines of 30 or 45 or 60 days never really get met. But we think that there's going to be a point where the developer is going to go public. And if they've stayed within our rules, they're okay doing so. As long as they're not selling it and as long as they're as they're sort of merely informing the public about it, they're safe. And we think, frankly, you're right, that the norms of the security community do a lot of work here, which is they're not going to say, here's the code to exploit it. They're going to describe in more generalized terms the worry. Second point is a question about liability for badly designed software. This is like the great path not taken or not traveled by in terms of tort law with software. Software is like a giant exception to negligence in every other rule. You can create just terrible software, and it's like, hey, you know, we put on the box that it's bad, and you bought it anyway. The answer that you get from the industry and from tort scholars is that it's just ruinously expensive to have something like enterprise liability or even negligence liability for software. I am not really convinced of that. There's been some greater sort of undercurrent of movement in the legal scholarship recently to think a little harder about this. It would be nice to have some rule that had a little bit of grip, right? So if you actually know about the bug, you never do anything about it, and it turns out that it's sort of hugely harmful, you get held to that. But I don't think that's the doctrine right now, and I'm not sure that it's kind of going anywhere. And lastly, the Fire Sheep example. So, I mean, Fire Sheep, right, is civil disobedience. Yeah. And civil disobedience comes with the price of accepting the consequences of that, right? So it doesn't matter if you're sitting at the lunch counter if you have a get-out-of-jail-free card, because then it's not a morally courageous act. Fire Sheep matters not just because it draws attention, but because you are willing to own the risk that the trade-off is worth it. The pointing out that everybody's vulnerable makes people safer as opposed to making them more in jeopardy.
About software liability. Actually, I've totally forgotten it, so never mind.
Well, I was actually going to bring up a similar point about liability. I mean, I know with the recent PSN hack that I think there's plans to go forward with a suit against Sony for data breach, and I could see how if, in that case, the hackers had sent information to Sony beforehand saying, hey, by the way, we found this, and there was a clearinghouse for that information, that could be sort of the smoking gun in court in sort of a civil, like, holding somebody responsible for a data breach. So I could see that the clearinghouse, other than also protecting hackers, could also protect consumers from companies not doing any action.
It's kind of an interesting example because the vulnerabilities in the PlayStation Network weren't unknown. They were woefully behind in their patches. And it's hard to say how this would react to that, right? I mean, because they were running a service and they were using known software like Apache. They were like 6 months behind or something. So it's not even that they didn't know that they were vulnerable. And should they be liable for that? I don't know. That's kind of an interesting...
It's a really hard question, right? So it gets into everything from data breach to PCI questions to, there's all sorts of stuff in there. We deliberately just steered clear because it's a swamp, right? Yeah. We have enough problems with trying to break IP law. Breaking tort law at the same time was like way too many. That's at least a separate paper. So in general, right, we are actually really sympathetic to this movement, that we think that some greater liability would create incentives for better software, but it's just harder, and I'm not particularly specialized in torts. So we felt much more comfortable with the shield law as sort of a first step.
What is your opinion of vulnerabilities in open source software? I mean, I assume there's no specific liability to disclosing them, but I'm wondering if you think there should be rules to ensure, you know, responsible disclosures as opposed to selling vulnerabilities to the Russian mafia, or if you've looked at case studies of seeing how open source software vulnerabilities are handled and disclosed versus how vulnerabilities where there could be a danger of a corporation going after you are handled and disclosed.
Yeah, I think it's just as important. Open source software runs some of the most important parts of the internet. DNS had a very big flaw recently that we had to struggle to patch secretly because you can read all the source code online. I see more benefit for society when it's open source because then you can actually learn the same lessons that the software vendor learned. Because it's all open source, you can actually read the code and see, oh, look, that's what they fixed. Whereas with closed source software, the best you have is when you get the security patch, you can disassemble it and study it enough, and maybe you can figure out what it was that they patched, but you never really know what all their source code looks like anyway. I think, even better when it's open source.
It's hotly debated. I mean, I think that the better weight of the theoretical arguments is on the side of open source as a sort of merely as an information theory problem. The empirical data is hopelessly biased. So it's difficult to think of what a sort of neutral baseline is anyway. And it's typically done by either somebody who's a vendor, so they're suspicious, open source advocates, equally suspicious, or somebody who's a consultant, right, where just want to say everything's buggy, hire us. So in terms of open source, I think Oliver and I are on the same page, which is that we think there's a lot of virtue to it, and we suspect that it's a better situation. I don't actually know whether the sort of level of threats is lower from open source vendors. My suspicion is that it is, but I'm not sure I have empirical data to back that up.
What do you mean?
In other words, if we look at sort of like a Red Hat or somebody, mm-hmm. are they less likely to sue than, say, Oracle?
Red Hat? I don't know. I mean, open source in general, I think, has less money.
Well, you guys have a really well-defined process for just putting the patch in yourself, like especially sure. large places like Red Hat or Fedora. You can go look at their website, like, how would I just apply this to the right place? And then someone will look at it and be like, ooh, shit, I'm glad someone patched that. So I feel like for big ones, it's an easy process. For like a project that's a few years out of date and doesn't have any current contact information, like you might send it and get really frustrated because that guy doesn't have that address anymore and never heard back. But mm-hmm. for the big ones, like I think they're precise and it's really clear how you would submit a patch.
Right.
And I think this might be idealistic on my part, but they rely so much on the good faith of their user community that they would be unwilling to jeopardize that with frivolous legal action.
They'd usually rather put the energy into hustling until they can fix it. Rather than starting a lawsuit, you know, but they'll like they're mad if you senselessly disclose like a bug in WordPress, they'll be like, what were you thinking? Like if you had spent 5 minutes looking, you could have found the security email and sent it just to us.
Right.
And they care because they run $1 million business on that. So you get a lot of, but they're not gonna abuse copyright or trademark law in an attempt to silence your speech,
right.
Which is like the really messed up thing that you guys are worried about, and that is like, how do you fix that? But it's the same thing as any speech, right? Like if you say McDonald's has unhealthy food, they're gonna sue you because you use the word McDonald's, like hoping you won't fight back.
I think it's actually worse, weirdly enough, which is that like IP law very strangely is like this exemption from the First Amendment. So if you read the case on this, like, oh, well, we've got fair use and other stuff. No, you know, nothing to see here. Please disperse. Which is ridiculous, right? This is prior restraint in the sort of classic sense of not allowing newspapers to publish. And it totally goes by the boards. First Amendment people just never sort of react to this. But I think your point's a really important one, which is one of the things that is kind of in the background of what we're doing, why this is an interesting peer production study, is that we rely a lot on stuff like social structures, right? So it's having the social structure that actually takes information and moves it from the discoverer to a point where it's useful. And in some ways, open source is configured for exactly that, and closed source isn't. So one of the things that we try to do in the paper is that if you're a vendor, right, what you would have to do is publish in the same way that if you, like every website out there, has a DMCA agent where you, for takedowns, right, you have to put it there and make it sort of available, and you have to register it with the Library of Congress and so forth. We want the same thing. We want a single point of contact for people who find bug feeds, and we want it basically, right, either on the home page of their website or on the about page or something like that. We want to cut information costs. And we think that that sort of model is something that is sort of really kind of low-hanging fruit that could improve things. Yes?
I was wondering what your thoughts are on third-party clearinghouses that are paid. So iDefense and Tipping Point, who are third parties that accept money, but they're also clearinghouses, which kind of contradicts two of you guys' points on the last slide.
Right. So one of the things, right, in some ways this is actually an alternative to clearinghouses. So if you want to sell the bug to Tipping Point, you've already broken the rule, right? So the second rule is you don't sell it. And I'm okay with that for the following reason. We're assuming that the whoever's got the bug is going to look at these two things and is going to choose the path they think is better. And our assumption is just contract law is really flexible. So if there's this set of threats out there, and you might get it, you might get sued even for selling it to Tipping Point, your contract with Tipping Point is going to take that into consideration. You're either going to get paid a lot more, or there's going to be some indemnification procedure or something like that. So we think that, the two should operate perfectly in parallel. This is just something that's an alternative if you don't want to sell on the private market.
Right. But I do think this is probably the model, unless something like this gets adopted. I think this is the model that most people are trending towards, right?
Yeah, and these problems are stuff. I worked at iDefense a long time ago, and when they first started going to Microsoft or Oracle and saying, hey, we've got this bug that somebody gave to us, fix this, then there were some serious issues there, but eventually contracts were hammered out that, now Oracle, you're right, can still be a bit more difficult to deal with, but Microsoft's like, great, give us the bug, we'll get it fixed, here you go, done. Right. I think it's a hashing out process that has played out on that side, but I agree that it's slightly different, but you can run it parallel.
Maybe in the back.
You guys have some good typologies in the beginning of motivations. What about why companies react the way they do? Are they afraid? I mean, Molly brought up a great point I wouldn't have thought of. Are they afraid of liability? Are they just lazy? Are they more concerned about nobody knowing that they screwed up rather than fixing it? I mean, what are the motivations that are driving this whole problem?
You'd have to ask them.
I mean, there's so many, but how would you identify them and categorize them? Or is that just not your approach?
I don't know. I've only worked with a few corporate lawyers. I think mostly it's them being sort of reactionary, reacting in the only way that they know how, which is
saying it's reactionary. Reactionary on what basis?
What's that?
Reactionary on what basis? What are they afraid of?
Like this is embarrassing. This is going to hurt
our stock price. So it's embarrassing.
It's a security through obscurity thing, which is silly, but
right.
I think that it's
You told everybody. We've got to stop you from telling everybody.
Right,
because if nobody knows about it, gosh, it won't be exploited.
Right, right. I mean, the things I've heard publicly is they'll say, oh, well, now everybody knows about it, and people will be able to exploit all those poor people. They've also said, like, this is going to be terrible for our brand. We can't allow this. And we will use everything in our power, and they have a lot, to make this stop. But I don't know. I haven't really talked to them a lot about what motivated them. I imagine their paycheck and their job. This is what they do. This is what they're supposed to do.
There is something in the institutional setup that creates these perverse incentives. And just as a point of curiosity, I don't think it would make much of a difference if we understood that, but it might help illuminate how we could go about assuaging those fears or addressing them or even legislating against them, if we want to be hostile.
One thing that I think is a really interesting point about this is it'd be very difficult to do this as an empirical matter, but it'd be fascinating to see how the data routes internally. My strong suspicion is that when these things come in, there's two paths that it takes, probably roughly simultaneously. One is to development or QE, and the second is to the general counsel's office. Development or QE will try to solve the problem. The general counsel's office will draft a cease and desist letter, right? When you have a hammer, the world is full of nails. And so what do lawyers do, right? Lawyers are like, this is an infringement of our intellectual property, like, release the hounds, right? And so that's the difficulty that we're looking at here. Whereas in some ways, the engineering mindset is better. Now, I do think that there are non-self-interested arguments, as Oliver pointed out, for trying to sort of constrain the disclosure. One is that legitimately, especially if you're something like Cisco or Microsoft, where it's not just that incorporating the bug fix into your code, but it's testing for downstream contingencies and a million configurations and so forth, you really do have some work that has to be done before people go public. And you don't want to, you don't necessarily want to put people at risk. And the second is that there is money at stake. So if you look, for example, one of the things we cite in the paper is SunCom, right? When Alex Halderman comes out with his bit that you can get around that thing by holding down the shift key, right? So that you disable autoplay. Their stock goes through the floor, right? They take a huge hit. And so quarterly earnings matter in corporations. And so I think that they're worried about that. Or, as Oliver mentioned with brands, right? Cisco, part of the reason that it's, you know, you buy Cisco. You never get fired for buying Cisco because it's bulletproof. It's not. Right? So it has an Achilles heel. Oh my God, right? That sort of brand, that perception in the marketplace is enormously valuable. And so they are, in fact, fearful that that's going to be pierced. So I think you're right. It'd be a nice sociological study, right? Sort of the law in action.
I think also to some degree the legal profession has a lot of sort of habits of doing things that aren't particularly well suited to the digital age. So like if I came and I said, I saw you bury those bodies, you kill me, I'm gone, the bodies are buried, it's all over. But it's like, hey, I noticed this thing in the website that if I change the numbers, that you can get into anyone's bank account you want. And they're like, we'll get rid of you. And it's like, but it's still there in the browser for everyone who logs in. Like, so it's not going to go away, and understanding that it's not going to go away, you know, even if you get rid of the person who saw it first, like, anyone can look at any time and see it. And so I don't think that the habits of the legal profession have completely caught up with that situation.
I think that's right. So one sort of great myth, right, is that only one person discovers the bug. Absolutely not true with software. And also, weirdly enough, Mark Lemley has a piece on this about patents, that sort of people invent stuff at the same time all the time. So it turns out that if you look at the history of mathematics, three different people invent non-Euclidean geometry within a year of each other. So I think the two in Europe are Leibniz and Euler. And you have Lobachevsky, right, who's at a second-rate university.
He had it 30 years earlier.
Oh, I didn't
know
that.
He sat on it because he thought people would think he was crazy.
That's great. So he has the zero day, right, and he just hoards it. But the idea is, right, and so eventually people come up with this. The idea that, oh, we're going to, like, silence this person, right, we're going to bury you, is incredibly unwise. But I think you're right, it's extremely sort of potent still. Is it like, you know, this is sort of, get Ellsberg, nobody will find out about the Pentagon Papers.
It seems like it's still like when you present this information, it seems like you've got a lot of good sociological research about what motivates hackers, but that you really should present what motivates these people causing these lawsuits, because your first reaction was the reaction I would have as well. They're crazy because they're nuts and paranoid, but that's the way they look at the hackers, because they're evil and they want to trick everyone. So without that understanding of what motivates the sewers, you're never going to, it's going to be hard to convince Congress or whatever body you want to change these laws, because changing the IP law, that's a dead-end battle, as some people are in this community have already come to the conclusion. But getting this, like, provision in place, what you want is a provision that they actually want to use, that these tech companies will look at and say, okay, now that this is, like, a law or whatever it is, whenever we get one of these security things, we carefully assess it in the framework, and then we can decide if it's on the right side or the wrong side, and then potentially go our nutso IP law, do everything we can to take it down, or engage with it carefully. But if you don't have respect from them, it's not going to work. Whereas if you do it properly and you get, like, some of the better companies, maybe Oracle will never sign on for this, but if you get, like, Google to be interested in making it a law, like, Google loves to make things laws. So getting, understanding them seems like at least half of understanding.
And they're going to fight any attempts to do otherwise, and they have the money and, you know, lobbyists and whatnot. So it's, yeah, just as a practical matter.
Understanding what?
It's a good point.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful, actually. We had probably given up a little too quickly on the possibility of industry support, probably because, you know, coming from the IP space, you're like, dead issue, right? Like, it's a nice proposal, but it's too far uphill. But I think that's right, is that we might actually be able to get support for it.
Does this proposal contain any sort of understanding or modifications for when companies cease to support a given product?
Abandonware. I don't know how abandonware would be dealt with.
One thing right now is I think Microsoft just decided they no longer support XP, which right. kind of sucks for all the people in China who are running pirated copies of XP.
We thought a little bit about it. Probably not hard enough. I mean, my safe reaction is that I think the framework still holds, but we need to think harder about that.
Yeah. There was a question over there.
I was just going to say, as someone who hopes to operate in both the legal and the IP sphere, toning down the rhetoric is nice, and trying to understand both sides I think is key to making this work. But all the talk, I think, that I've heard and all the questions has been from the corporate angle, and I wondered if you all had thought about public sector, either nonprofits or government entities, and if this proposal would fit within that as well. And whether, I just feel like a lot of the talk of the supposed Chinese nationalists attacking American companies, and whether or not that's the government or whether or not that's just their own going out on their own, trying to further their own agenda. So do you have any idea of whether this would work for the federal government as well?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So let me make sure that we're getting your question right, which is, are you thinking about something like custom-built software? So the federal government contracts out
right.
software. Okay. And so then the federal government itself is the vendor. So that's tricky, right? And you're right that this actually implicates the criminal law problem fairly significantly, because the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, right? It's just much easier to bring a prosecution if it is on the protected computers of a federal agency or whatnot. So we have to think about it a little bit. My sense is that the civil provisions still work, but it might be a zone where we might want some greater leeway from criminal prosecution. The difficulty here, right, is that I'm a lot less worried from a cybersecurity perspective about security researchers probing the Pentagon than I am about nation states doing it. And so there's one where the flaws won't get reported, right? They'll just get exploited. And in some ways, I mean, this is sort of a separate project that Oliver and I have talked about a little bit, which is sort of cybersecurity and cyber espionage more generally. I think our provision operates in a much more benign world, right, where it's essentially sort of, it is a corporate private sector set of players as opposed to public sector.
You know, my initial fear is that if, no matter what we would put in place, national security is a trump card that always works. So if it's a government system, you're probably not going to have any type of protection no matter what's in place. There could be a law that says you are explicitly allowed to hack the government. They would still call it a trump card and say, national security, sorry, you're in trouble. Yeah, I'm also the more pessimistic of the two of us, so keep that in mind.
So I think when we say the government, like, I mean, here it's like the government. It sounds like one massive, like, monolithic entity. But I think as far as software development and support, it behaves as a lot of little fiefdoms. And so some parts are going to be, like, I wouldn't go hack into the CIA, but if you were looking at, like, say, maybe a naval recruiting site, and you're like, hey, it's really easy to put like 9 million people in there that are potentially interested in joining the Navy. So like, there's places that you could start that would be like, oh, okay, thanks. And you know, now we have a relationship and we have some understanding of what the value of having somebody report bugs to us is. but yeah, I think if with some industry experience behind doing that kind of a model, like a group or a third party and sort of clearinghouse, that you could begin to build relationships with certain aspects of the government before like jumping in and being like, hey, this guy was just about to sell stuff to China from the CIA. You could start a little lower.
It's a great idea, especially, you know, increasingly the trend of outsourcing means that there's a sort of weird relationship where the vendor, right, the government probably owns the code and may even own the IP rights, but you have a vendor who's updating it and so forth. So there may be some sort of interstices there that we could work on.
I mean, especially like the U.S. Navy uses a lot of free software and then does actually push a lot of changes back upstream. So they're a little bit unique. There are other places that do that on a very small scale, but the Navy is pretty good about it. And so they understand the back and forth and having like the many eyes shallow bugs thing.
So that's great. Thanks. That's really Navy's a good example.
Yep, I'm back.
So I feel like there's two different. So as we get more problems in the recent times, it's less about like Microsoft Word crashing because you push these combination of buttons at this time or something, and it's more about I found an exploit that basically exposes personal data. And so I wonder, are those like two separate issues? Because in one it's like there's like it's just bad code. In the other one it's like you have access to, you know, some large number of people's personal data, be it like their passwords or their credit card numbers and this sort of thing. And in one situation it's like, it's fine, it's like a bug, that's fine. But like in the other one it's like, should these companies be liable for it? Like, does that change? Is there a different nature between those two types of things?
You know, based on my experience, every crashing bug is an exploit that wasn't developed properly. If you find a really good security researcher, they can take most crashes and turn them into working exploits. So I can't really differentiate those two things. I know there's other people in this room that have experience in this industry as well. So I mean, if you feel differently, please speak up now. It's hard for me to you know, like separate those. Does that seem reasonable?
The problem, right, that you identify is that in some senses, like crashing Microsoft Word is lower stakes than being able to breach PSN or a health records database or something like that. So in this sense, you have the difficulty. This is cloud computing. Right, which is you have a lot of really valuable data that lives behind fairly porous walls. And so that's a hard question, right? Like what we really want the project to do is to encourage this type of research. Cloud computing desperately needs it, right? I mean, the PSN hack is, you know, SQL injection attacks are still legion, which is idiotic, right? This is sort of a really easy fix. I think you're thinking, which is liability, is right. There's a whole set of problems there about how we sort of balance the costs and get that tweaking right, whether tort law is a good way to do it. But we're really interested in whether we need to shift this framework as a way of getting more cloud computing research.
Yeah, I think, if you advance that to the cloud argument, I think it becomes more interesting. Like, if I can just make your website 503 me, that's one thing. But if I can actually get your SQL database, that's something that we should talk about, right? Should that be extended as well? And obviously, I'm more or less in favor of that.
If the nature of the bug or exploit that you find is something that exposes your user's personal data, does that, you know, should in the framework, should it allow like a certain liability then be placed on the company that creates the software?
No, when you say expose, like, do you mean like if you forgot to turn off track comments in your Word document and it exposes all the nasty things you said about the person's writing?
No, I mean like in your 503 versus, you know, SQL injection thing. Okay. Like if you have something that's actually exposing your user base's data, does that actually is that different enough that it should sort of enact some sort of liability on the company if they decide, like, if they go the route of that's great, but we're going to go the security through obscurity route?
I mean, that seems more of a consumer issue than a corporate issue. I think consumers are the ones that are really getting hurt right now through exposure of personal information. If I have your name and your social security number, I can pretty much figure out everything else I need to start new credit accounts in your name. It doesn't happen as much on the corporate side, I feel like, but...
The primary victims in these cases is because there is no liability on the corporate side. If there was liability on the corporate side, or if we had a sufficiently developed like cyber insurance system where there could be financial penalties enacted through any number of means on the corporate side, then corporations would consider themselves to have a financial stake. As it is, it's like, oh, oops. Sorry.
No, it's absolutely true.
I tend to agree. So the tricky thing about what you're saying, right, is, and I think what Oliver is getting at, is if we're interested in the wall, the wall is sort of what our thing does. The tricky part is what's behind the wall. It matters a lot to me, socially speaking, whether when you breach it, you get people's health records versus you get, like, lolcats, right? So the lolcats, I still might not like the fact that you breached the wall, but it's not a grave social concern that, you know, it's changing the spelling on those things. And my suspicion there, it's sort of partly a bad lolcat joke, is that what we really should do there is we should actually be using a different set of laws. Right. So what we're worried about is we want to tune it by industry. So we have HIPAA, right, as modified by the High Tech Act. We have Gramm-Leach-Bliley for financial data. We have a series of other things that talk about when you hold information of sufficient sensitivity, there are steps that you should have to take. And HIPAA is probably the best at doing this. That's the sort of thing where I would prefer to actually see the energy go for dealing with stuff like data breach, just because it's very hard to use the SHIELD law when you're talking about what's behind it. It gets too complicated in terms of the tweaking.
Do you think an exemption like this one, if it became real, would encourage any kind of tourism on the part of corporations? For example, I mean, given that a server could be located anywhere,
right,
if a researcher came forward and said, I see this weakness in your server, and it happens to be one overseas, and a company knew that this kind of exemption was available, would that encourage them to look to sue civilly in a different country?
I think that's quite possible. I've heard of people shopping and going to the UK for slander stuff because apparently you can get sued for anything over there. Libel tourism. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know if it would mean people would relocate outside of the US so that they wouldn't suddenly be shielded from hackers. I've definitely seen it go the other way. Europe has passed some interesting and controversial laws about security tools, saying that if you have a hacking tool and you even look at it funny, you're liable as a criminal. A lot of security researchers have fled from Germany in the sense that nothing they do is located in Germany anymore. Everything is located outside of Germany, even if they live inside of Germany. And it's part of the European, like, cybercrime framework. So it's a very bad precedent, I'm certainly unhappy about it. I don't know how, like, we haven't talked about this, so I don't know how you would feel if companies would start sort of shifting maybe their IP development outside of the U.S. so that it would be protected somehow?
The tricky thing, right, is so many considerations that go into it. A lot of times you'll locate your IP offshore anyway because of tax reasons, so it was really popular to put it in Ireland for a while. The difficulty here is that cloud computing may let companies engage in some strategic behavior. So, like Akamai, right? I mean, Akamai's got a data store that's replicated everywhere in the world. If I make a change to something or I poke at something, it arguably gets replicated everywhere. Now, at least potentially, I've got jurisdiction wherever an Akamai server is located. So maybe if I've got one that's in Berlin, now I'm in really good shape. Now, I may not be able to get you here in Cambridge from Berlin. There's a series of protections that attach. But that sort of is relocation on the cheap. As to whether people are actually going to push their stuff offshore, I think it happens, but I think that corporations are so much less likely to do it because they're much more rational actors, right? And so they have all this stuff that goes into the calculus. And this is probably too small. On the other hand, I think that the worry the other way, as Oliver points out, is huge. If you change the rules, you're going to have a massive effect on the people who engage in the research, right? So they all avoid Germany. For a while after Title I of the DMCA passed, you had a bunch of people saying, that's it, I'm not doing research on DRM here in the States anymore because I might be like Dmitry Skolyarov, right, and I'll get arrested when I show up in Vegas. That's probably lessened somewhat, but we think that it's sort of asymmetric in the way that the incentives to worry about relocating work.
And this did happen in the U.S. as well. For a while, the U.S. government was really bent on banning encryption because they couldn't read our emails. Why would they want that to happen? So they tried the Clipper chip. That failed, thankfully. But for a while, a lot of people in the U.S. were like, that's it. We're not doing stuff here anymore. It doesn't make any sense. So they would put all their encryption stuff, all the development of, like, e-commerce software, which is really reliant on cryptology, would be produced outside the U.S., even by U.S. companies. And I think the government finally came around and said, we've lost this one. Sorry. We're just going to have to let this go. And I feel like it would maybe have sort of the inverse effect, right? If we produced a shield, maybe more researchers would start basing their stuff out of here. And I think a really interesting sort of development is the whole cyber war concept, right? Now, we kind of really need these exploits as literally a source of national defense, right? And so we really should be encouraging
security researchers to help out and do the right thing. And when I say do the right thing, I literally mean giving the exploit to the corporation, right? Like, you can sell these things now. Like, this wasn't a real big issue back in the 90s. Now, you can make legitimate money. How much did iFence pay for, like, say, a Windows bug?
Big, one that would get rude would be, like, 10 grand or something.
Okay.
That's a lot lower than on the black market, and it's a lot lower than what the U.S. government would pay for it as well.
Right, right. So we're already developing markets, right? And so it's going to get trickier, unfortunately. yes?
Under current law, what's your best advice to a hacker who runs a major bug? If their only purpose is to get it fixed?
But only to get it fixed? The best example I've seen so far is when Alex Sadarov found a bug, an SSL bug. He went to a third party, Microsoft. Amazingly, he went to Microsoft. And he had them mediate. So that way there was a literal proxy between the researcher and the very angry company that received the notification. I don't know that everyone has those resources. Alex was already a star researcher. He already had contacts deep in Microsoft that could broker this. But that would be my advice. You don't want to be in the direct line of fire if it's a really big company, if they're particularly litigious. But also to look at the history, right? If it's Google, they've been fairly decent about it. Microsoft, in the last, say, 10 years, has really come around. And as long as you don't ask Microsoft for money, they're not going to do anything bad to you. Interestingly, Microsoft has already put their foot down and said, we're never going to have a bounty program. But the short answer is, find someone to represent you and make sure they know what they're doing as well.
Are there trusted organizations willing to play that role?
Not so much. Maybe the EFF. That would be my first. I would say contact them. Yes. Right. Right. I mean, the EFF is usually my go-to for this type of problem.
You could probably also hit up the
Center.
Yes. Because the EFF has a lot of questions. Yeah, I bet. If you're looking at something that's like, oh, I don't want to lose my house.
A suggestion that we've had is that our structural mechanism of the clearinghouse is one that we envisioned as like some nonprofit organization, but it's been suggested that lawyers are well positioned to do it. That might be right. It's a little hard when you try to figure out who the lawyer's duty is to, ethically speaking, but you could imagine somebody forming a nonprofit that solely acts as a sort of shield, right? The difficulty there is keeping the nonprofit from getting sued. So they're either a lawyer for the hacker, which carries some difficulties just in terms of sort of them sort of playing honest middleman, or they're not, in which case they're vulnerable to discovery. So we haven't been able to tweak that. But I think Oliver's advice generally is right, and I would be thrilled if somebody wanted to start a project. Jennifer Granick does a little bit of this work. Wanted to start a project like, hey, we represent security researchers. That would be great. Yeah, exactly. Berkman Center. I've been trying to pitch the clinic at Brooklyn Law School on this for a while without a lot of success because they just don't like angry tech companies coming after them. But like, for anybody who wants to tilt at a particularly productive windmill, you should talk to me and Oliver.
So it sounds like your answer is there's no good way to avoid liability. There's only trust. And if you have a sufficiently trustworthy organization approaching the company with the bug, then you might avoid a lawsuit. But in fact, they could sue anyone. Mm-hmm. And so if you were the nonprofit organization, you'd have to worry about liability. So under current law, there is no path around liability for a hacker who finds it.
The weird thing is, right, I mean, IP law operates in a zone of strict liability. It's just intent is utterly irrelevant. So almost everything that people are doing is probably a violation of copyright. It's a derivative work. So that's civil liability right there with sort of the statutory damages hammer behind it. God help you if you're in the zone of patent infringement, which is even worse than copyright. You have DMCA problems. Trade secret is big here. You have the Federal Espionage Act, which reifies most trade secret violations into federal crimes. It's like it is a parade of horribles, and it's weird, right? Like, oh, geez, all I found was some code that doesn't do what I thought it should. So it is one of those things where sort of the law on the ground, which is most of the time people don't sue over this stuff, versus the law on the books, which presents a significant threat, are sort of wildly divergent.
I wonder if you could use this back in advocacy for your privilege. The best advice we can give to hackers is to shut up and go home. And you've got bugs like the bank account URL that you pointed out, which will create major harm if nobody steps forward. So if the best advice you can give people is to be quiet and cause harm or allow harm to continue. That's a reason to adopt.
That's a great suggestion. I really like that. Yeah.
So
So you talked about hackers as whistleblowers and, you know, and sort of the suggestion if you just want to get your bug fixed quickly and that's all you care about. I mean, I know this wouldn't be the most socially responsible aspect, but my thought was, well, why not just, you know, disclose the bug and exploit details anonymously online and, you know, if as soon as they track you down, you don't have to worry about liability. It might cause problems to other people, but at least it would make the vendor fix it right away. Have you sort of seen people doing that? Do you have any thoughts on situations
like
people...
the bank seems like an example of like...
Yeah, I mean, people certainly have been doing it. And the reason that we don't really advocate that is probably my fault. I was pretty much a proponent of Rainforest Puppy, who it's a handle. That's what his handle was. And so he had responsible disclosure doctrine, right? And it's been recently ratified by Microsoft as the, do you remember what they called it? They came up with some new funny name. They took the word responsible out and they added something else, coordinated disclosure. So, I mean, there's some pros and cons with coordinated disclosure, but for the most part, I think just giving out full details comes with a lot of problems. Specifically, if I said, hey, everybody, there's this way that you can get into banks and just look at any account that you want, the bank should really fix that. Oh, I haven't told them yet, but I am now. That might create a small race condition that would just be, you know, catastrophic. So I'm generally in favor of notifying them first, and when they don't play nice, then going forward and saying, look, I've done everything I can to fix this. They've ignored me. They've told me they're going to send lawyers. Here's the bug. Here's the details. And I think it's more important when, I mean, in the past, it was like, this is software that everyone uses. And the idea was, as a system administrator, you should know about these details so that when you see these attacks coming into your network, you can defend yourself, right? And this has been the business model of Tipping Point, which is owned by 3Com. They produce an IPS, an intrusion prevention system. And they buy the 0 days so that their product can protect you as their customer against these things while the companies are patching them, right? So, I mean, this is also sort of a weird situation that I'm not hugely thrilled about. But, you know, this is kind of where it's all going towards if we don't sort of rein it in.
The problem with anonymous disclosure, right, is hard to be taken seriously. So if you just post it to some blog, nobody's going to pay attention to it, which runs counter to the goal of getting it fixed. On the other hand, the indicia of reliability typically have to do with the attribution of the researcher, right? So the reason that Alex Sodorov gets taken seriously is because he's Alex Sodorov. And so you have to find some happy medium where you both signal credibility and yet you don't leave a trail where you can get sued. Very, very hard to do, right? So something like your intermediary might work at doing this, because that was our thinking, right, is that over time, if you have people sort of checking in bugs to this clearinghouse, they'll build a trail that shows they're reliable even if they're anonymous. But it's hard to have both. We are almost at time, so maybe one more question and then we'll wind down. We dissuaded everybody.
I was just going to add, so you were talking about a nonprofit or lawyers, and I think that any successful venture is going to be a nonprofit composed almost fully of lawyers, right? And maybe someone to answer the phone.
Yeah.
And, you know, or raise money. I think that's like from beginning to end, not just like checking and making sure that the anonymous stuff that's arriving in the clearinghouse is actually like being done in the proper way, but also just setting up that nonprofit so that it's not vulnerable for RICO statute sort of stuff. So, yeah, you're
going to
need lawyers.
Yes. Hackers need lawyers, right? That's our happy closing note, is that we can all sort of live in peace. Okay, so thank you very much for having us. This has been a lot of fun.